This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته لن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines, Iran says it's a 20% uranium enrichment and other nuclear measures are fully reversible upon full compliance of all parties to the deal. Saudi Arabia decides to reopen its borders with Qatar as a years-long blockade by Riyadh and its regional allies fails to force Doha to bow down to demands. And Asian stock markets fall amid uncertainty about U.S. Senate runoffs, a coronavirus surge, and new lockdowns. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran says it has produced the first batch of 20% enriched uranium in the presence of IAEA inspectors at its Fordo facility. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the measure is a remedial action after years of noncompliance by the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal.
Announcing today.
It was on May the 8th, 2018, where the U.S. president unilaterally withdrew Washington from the internationally recognized 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Following the pullout, Donald Trump left no stone unturned to implement his so-called policy of maximum pressure on Tehran. In line with his policy, Trump not only reimposed sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the agreement, but also came out with several new crippling measures against the Islamic Republic. In May 2019, Iran notified the remaining signatories to the JCPOA that Tehran would roll back some of its commitments under the deal. It cited failure of the signatories to secure the Islamic Republic's interest, in particular in oil and banking sectors, in the face of Washington's pullout and sanctions. But Britain, Germany, and France, known as E3, failed to take any practical measures, even during the coronavirus pandemic, when U.S. sanctions hampered Iran's efforts to purchase medicines and medical equipment. In the wake of Europe's inaction, the Iranian parliament passed a law last month. It called on the government to produce at least 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually and store it inside the country. In line with the legislation, Iran started the process to enrich uranium to 20% purity at its Fordow nuclear facility on Monday, a move that was confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Agency and carried out under the presence of its inspectors. And hours later, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced that the first batch of 20% uranium was produced. Iran's foreign minister defended the measure, saying it conforms with the JCPOA.
A remedial action conforms fully with paragraph 36 of JCPOA after years of non-compliance by several other JCPOA participants. Our measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by all.
Zarif assertions was echoed by the former ambassador of Iran to the IAEA, who is currently a senior consultant at the United Nations.
Each member state or each party to NPT could enrich to any level that they require for their consumptions that they have. The only obligation is to inform the IAEA to verify their declaration.
Iran has maintained that its steps to reduce its JCPOA commitments are completely and quickly reversible as soon as the U.S. and Europe return to their own commitments under the deal. Now the ball is in the court of Europe and the incoming administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to practically show whether they are determined to salvage the deal.
Kuwait says Saudi Arabia is lifting a border blockade on Qatar 3 years after Riyadh and some of its regional allies instigated measures to isolate Doha.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf al-Ahmad al-Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
The Kuwaiti foreign minister also said a declaration towards resolving the political dispute is expected to be signed at a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday. Qatar's royal court also said Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani has accepted an invitation to attend the summit. In 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, broke ties with Qatar, issuing a 13-point list of demands, which included the closure of the Al Jazeera television network and a downgrade of relations with Iran in return for reconciliation. Qatar has long rejected these demands as unreasonable. Activist and commentator Robert Fontina says Saudi Arabia and its allies have been unable to force Qatar to bow to their wishes.
Nothing, which is why it is now willing to, it says, negotiate a resolution to it. Saudi Arabia and the other countries that joined in the blockade and issued the 13-point demands were simply trying to force Qatar to bend to their wishes, which Qatar wasn't willing to do. So the blockade resulted in no significant damage to the Qatari economy. The demands, the 13 demands, were all ridiculous in that they simply, if Qatar had given into them, it would have just been surrendering its own sovereignty because of the demands that were made by these countries.
A bomb explosion has reportedly targeted a U.S.-led coalition convoy north of the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Local media cited a security source as saying that the blast ripped through the convoy carrying logistical equipment in Saladin Governorate. The source said the explosion caused no casualties. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in Iraq in recent months, amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Tensions escalated after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January 2020. Iraqi people have time and again called for the expulsion of U.S. troops from the country. Now, Asian markets slide during morning trade on Tuesday, following a sharp drop on Wall Street the previous day. Hong Kong Stock Exchange was the hardest hit with a 0.5% drop. Markets in Shanghai and Tokyo dipped too. Similar trends were seen in Sydney, Seoul, and Singapore, among others. The losses came after all three main indices on Wall Street fell more than 1%. That's amid uncertainty over a key runoff vote in the U.S. state of Georgia. The vote could decide the control of the U.S. Senate. Markets are also affected by a coronavirus surge that has resulted in further lockdowns in the U.S. The situation has raised concerns about the prospects of the economy there in the first quarter of 2021. Now, for more on that, we're joined by Mr. Steve Keen, professor of economics at Patreon. If you could please tell us what your prediction is of the financial markets, especially in Asia.
Well, financial markets are being held aloft largely by government action. What we call quantitative easing has underwritten the American market dramatically. And, of course, it's been tried in Japan, Europe as well. Not yet in many Asian countries, but Australia's talking of doing it. And what it involves is the Federal Reserve using its limitless capacity to create money, to buy bonds off financial institutions, which encourages them to use that cash, which doesn't earn any income, to buy shares instead. And that's why we've had what we call the K-shaped recovery. This is going to continue regardless of who becomes the President of America, whether the rightful person or Donald Trump, as he fantasizes. So I think this is just a short-term disturbance. The markets will continue rising, not because they should, but because they're being pumped up by Federal Reserve and other central bank supports.
So how do you think that will affect the world market as a whole?
Well, what we've got is dramatically overvalued markets already. When you look at what's called the Shiller CAPE Index, which adjusts with the volatility of the market. The market is more overvalued than in any time in its history apart from 1929 and 2000. So any fear that passes through the market will cause a very abrupt fall, as this is done right now. But I think it'll all be overwritten by the basic backline, which most traders have got used to now: don't fight the Fed. And while the Fed continues to pump markets up with quantitative easing and other central banks follow their lead, we're likely to see markets continuing to maintain an unrealistic relationship to reality for the indefinite future.
And how do you think the runoff vote in the U.S. Senate could affect that?
It might finally get rid of Donald, which would be a good thing for everybody, including Donald. But the volume of money that the Federal Reserve is pumping into the markets is so extreme, of the order of $3 trillion during COVID so far, that it overwhelms people taking money off the table as they're doing right now. The Fed will dive right back in and try to rescue the market. As my good friend Michael Hudson puts it, the Fed is more concerned about rescuing the parasite, being the financial markets, than it is rescuing the host, which is the real economy.
Thank you very much for that comment, Mr. Steve Keen, professor of economics at Patreon. Moving on, U.S. President Donald Trump has repeated his claims that he has won the presidential election, including the race in the southern state of Georgia.
There's no way we lost Georgia. There's no way. That was a rigged election, but we're still fighting it, and you'll see what's going to happen. We'll talk about it. You know, I've had two elections. I won both of them. It's amazing. And I actually did much better on the second one.
During a rally in Georgia, Trump said President-elect Joe Biden is not taking the White House. Trump said that he is going to, quote, fight like hell to remain in power. Georgia is the state where the outgoing president pushed officials to find votes for him. Trump's Democratic rival Biden both won the electoral and popular votes in November 3rd, and Congress is due to certify the Electoral College votes this Wednesday before Biden officially takes office on January 20th. But Trump keeps refusing to concede defeat. The U.S. endures the deadliest week of the coronavirus pandemic, with more than 18,000 deaths as the vaccine rollout hits snags. According to the Johns Hopkins University tally, one COVID death was reported in the U.S. every 33 seconds. December also was the deadliest month since the start of the pandemic. Health officials have warned that more people are likely to die in January. So far, more than 353,000 fatalities have been reported out of over 20,780,000 confirmed cases. The country continues to report a steep rise in cases despite the rollout of COVID vaccines. The governor of New York and Florida have warned that they would reduce future allocations to those hospitals that failed to dispense shots quickly enough.
Any provider who does not use the vaccine could be fined up to $100,000. Going forward, they have to use the allocation within 7 days. Otherwise, they can be removed from future distribution.
The U.S. government has distributed over 15.4 million vaccines, but only about a quarter of them have actually been administered. Other countries around the world are also experiencing a slow rollout of COVID vaccines. In Spain, doctors and health experts have expressed disappointment over the slow start of vaccination. In France, the government has promised to ramp up its vaccination campaign after only a few hundred people received the doses in the first week, prompting accusations of a scandal. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced a new national COVID-19 lockdown in England to contain a more contagious variant of the coronavirus.
With most of the country already under extreme measures, it's clear that we need to do more together to bring this new variant under control while our vaccines are rolled out. In England, we must therefore go into a national lockdown which is tough enough to contain this variant. That means the government is once again instructing you to stay at home.
Now, Johnson said the surge in cases threatens to overwhelm parts of the health system before a vaccine program reaches a critical mass. The new restrictions include school closures from Tuesday and rules requiring most people to stay at home unless there are essential tasks. Johnson, however, said there is a possibility to start moving out of lockdown by mid-February if the outcome of the restrictions are positive enough. Several other European countries have already implemented similar restrictions amid a surge in cases and deaths. Ireland reported a record number of new COVID-19 cases for the fourth consecutive day. A British court in London has ruled that WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange cannot be extradited to the U.S. The judge blocked the request because of concerns over Assange's mental health and risk of suicide in the U.S. Our correspondent Ahmed Cabello has the details.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
Situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US, and internationally. Because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Cabello, London.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, Set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
More than 2,900 U.S. healthcare workers have died in the COVID-19 pandemic since March, a far higher number than that reported by the U.S. government, according to a new analysis by KHN and The Guardian. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Christina Jouet, Robert Lewis and Melissa Bailey writers. This article is published under the heading U.S. barely kept track of nearly 3,000 healthcare workers that died in 2020. Here's the details of this article. More than 2,900 U.S. healthcare workers have died in the COVID-19 pandemic since March, a far higher number than that reported by the government, according to a new analysis by KHN and The Guardian. Fatalities from the coronavirus have skewed young, with the majority of victims under the age of 60 in cases for which there is age data. People of color have been disproportionately affected, accounting for about 65% of deaths in cases in which there is race and ethnicity data. After conducting interviews with relatives and friends of around 300 victims, KHN and The Guardian learned that one-third of the fatalities involved concerns over inadequate personal protective equipment. Many of the deaths, about 680, occurred in New York and New Jersey, which were hit hard early in the pandemic. Significant numbers also died in southern and western states in ensuing months. The findings are part of Lost on the Frontline, a 9-month data and investigative project by KHN and The Guardian to track every healthcare worker who dies of COVID-19. One of those lost, Vincent D. Jesus, 39, told his brother Neil that he'd be in deep trouble if he spent much time with a COVID-positive patient while wearing the surgical mask provided to him by the Las Vegas hospital where he worked. DeJesus died on August 15th. Another fatality was Sue Williams Ward, a 60-year-old home health aide who earned $13 an hour in Indianapolis and bathed, dressed, and fed clients without wearing any PPE. Her husband said she was intubated for 6 weeks before she died on May 2nd. Loss on the front line is prompting new government action to explore the root cause of healthcare worker deaths and take steps to track them better. Officials at the Department of Health and Human Services recently asked the National Academy of Sciences for a rapid expert consultation on why so many healthcare workers are dying in the U.S., citing the count of fallen workers by Guardian and KHN. The question is, where are they becoming infected? Asked Michael Osterholm, a member of Joe Biden COVID-19 advisory team and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. That is clearly a critical issue we need to answer, and we don't have that, he added. The December 10th report by the National Academies suggests a new federal tracking system and especially trained contact tracers who would take PPE policies and availability into consideration. Doing so would add critical knowledge that could inform generations to come and give meaning to the lives lost. Those healthcare workers are people who walked into places of work every day because they cared about patients, putting food on the table for families, and every single one of those lives matter, said Sue Ann Bell, a University of Michigan assistant professor of nursing and co-author of the National Academy's report. The recommendations come at a fraught moment for healthcare workers as some are getting the COVID-19 vaccine while others are fighting for their lives amid the highest levels of infection the nation has seen. The toll continues to mount. In Indianapolis, for example, 41-year-old nurse practitioner Kendra Irons died on December 1st. She saw 7 or 8 home health patients per week while wearing full PPE, including an N95 mask and a face shield, according to her husband, Marcus Irons. The virus destroyed her lungs so badly that 6 weeks on the most aggressive life support equipment, ECMO, couldn't save her, he said. Marcus Irons said he is now struggling financially to support their 2 youngest children, ages 12 and 15. Nobody should have to go through what we are going through, he said. In Massachusetts, 43-year-old Mike Flynn oversaw transportation and laundry services at North Shore Medical Center, a hospital in Salem, Massachusetts. He and his wife were also raising young children ages 8, 10, and 11. Flynn fell ill in late November and died on December 8. He had a heart attack at home on the couch, according to his father, Paul Flynn. A hospital spokesperson said he had full access to PPE and free testing on site. Since the first month of the pandemic, more than 70 reporters at The Guardian and KHN have scrutinized numerous governmental and public data sources interviewed and the bereaved families spoken with them. The total number includes fatalities identified by labor unions, obituaries and news outlets, and in online postings by the bereaved, as well as by relatives of the deceased. The previous total announced by The Guardian and KHN was approximately 1,450 healthcare workers' deaths. The new number reflects the inclusion of data reported by nursing homes and health facilities to the federal and state governments. These deaths include the facility names but not worker names. Reporters cross-checked each record to ensure fatalities did not appear in the database twice. The tally has been widely cited by other media as well as by members of Congress. Representative Norma Torres referenced the data, citing the need for a pending bill that would provide compensation to the families of healthcare workers who died or sustained a long-term disabilities from COVID-19. Senator Ron Wyden mentioned the tally in a Senate Finance Committee hearing about the medical supply chain. "The fact is," he said, "the shortages of PPE have put doctors and nurses in the U.S. in grave danger."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
President-elect Joe Biden has formally announced many of his cabinet picks, boasting the most diverse cabinet in United States history. So who are these appointees? What are their records? And what are we really going to see from this incoming administration? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Joe Biden, whose campaign was practically dead in the water barely a year ago during the Democratic primaries, is now the president-elect of the United States. Things took a surprising turn when, during the Democratic primaries, several candidates all dropped out simultaneously and pledged their support behind Joe Biden, making the race a de facto head-to-head between him and Bernie Sanders. This Machiavellian move, with Obama making a few phone calls behind the scenes, cemented Joe Biden's status as the so-called frontrunner and saw the race narrow in his favor. Bernie Sanders soon dropped out and, just like he did in 2016, rallied behind the Democratic nominee without any opposition, rolling over and abandoning his grassroots movement of workers without obtaining any policy concessions from Biden. Bernie Sanders supporters and the progressive wing of the party were told once again that they absolutely needed to vote for the Democratic nominee for Biden because Donald Trump was an existential threat to the United States and that Biden was somehow the lesser of two evils. The Democratic Party knew it could count on them. It knew it could count on millions of Bernie supporters who had been sheepdogged back into the party. So why bother appeasing the left? Instead, we saw the Democratic Party invite neocon war criminals like Colin Powell to speak at their convention. The formation of groups like Republicans for Biden. Or even worse, the heinous Lincoln Project, a group of neoconservative war criminals from the Bush era like Rick Wilson, Bill Kristol, and Dick Cheney's daughter, making the case for Joe Biden. In essence, the Democratic Party and Biden's campaign tried more to appeal to right-wing voters and Republicans than to the left wing of their own party because no one was pressuring them from the left. And besides, that's exactly what Democrats are anyway. They are right-wingers. even policies supported by most Americans, both Republican and Democrat, like universal health care, were frowned upon by Biden. Biden flat out said that he would veto Medicare for All. Just looking at Joe Biden's record, having spent 40 years in Congress catering to credit card companies, to Wall Street, to the fossil fuel industry, authoring the 94 crime bill and jailing scores of young African-American men, helping to start the Iraq War and supporting virtually every U.S. military intervention, Joe Biden even shamelessly bragged about working with segregationists. Despite all of this, Americans were told that they needed to blindly pledge their vote for Joe Biden in order to get rid of Trump. We heard over and over how Americans must put aside their grievances, shut up, and vote for the blue war criminal because he was supposedly different from the red war criminal. In the words of Joe Biden's own wife, voters were told to swallow a little. All of this under the premise that once Joe Biden was elected, voters would be able to push him left. So here we are, months later, Joe Biden has won and been declared president-elect. And already he's walked back several of his campaign promises, including canceling student loan debts and rolling back Trump's immigration policies. Not only that, but he's made several key appointments to his cabinet, many of them familiar faces, old pals from the Obama days. The same people who took the United States from two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to seven wars in Syria, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan. The same people who expanded the NSA's mass surveillance programs, who sold billions of dollars to the Saudi Arabian regime in order to commit genocide in Yemen. The same people who dismantled the anti-war and Occupy movements. The same people who gave bailouts to Wall Street while forcing millions of Americans out of their homes. The same corporatist criminals and their neoliberal policies who led to Trump in the first place. So while Trump picked a cabinet of crooks who are DC outsiders, Biden also picks a bunch of crooks, but at least they're DC insiders. In fact, this very much pleases the liberal elites and the corporate establishment media. Why? Because of diversity, allegedly. Joe Biden bragged that his cabinet is the most diverse in United States history. These appointments have, of course, been lauded and praised by the mainstream media because they mean nothing in terms of structural change and have no effect on the goals of the U.S. empire. The liberal elites and the media establishment can continue to pretend that they celebrate minorities and people of color while oppressing those very same groups, both at home and abroad, under the veil of intersectional, rainbow-colored imperialism. So far, Joe Biden has appointed seven women to his White House communications team. He also appointed Neera Tanden to head the Office of Management and Budget. This is the same Neera Tanden, Clinton aide, who suggested in an email that Arab countries should pay the United States with their oil for invading them. Biden has tapped Avril Haines as the Director of National Intelligence, a former deputy director of the CIA, and an architect of Obama's horrific drone program, which has killed countless civilians across the Middle East. But I guess we shouldn't worry, right? Because she's a woman, and according to the New York Times, she's also a brown belt in judo, a pilot, and turned an old bar into a bookstore. Biden's foreign policy advisor, Tony Blinken, will now be his Secretary of State. Blinken is another familiar face from the Obama administration and a supporter of the imperialist wars on Libya, Syria, and Yemen. He signaled that Biden would continue to use the CSAR Act sanctions, keep U.S. troops inside of Syria, and continue occupying Syria's oil, just as Trump has done. Yet according to The Guardian, these minor transgressions should be overlooked because Blinken can apparently speak French and play the guitar. So I'm sure this will be very appreciated by many Syrians who are currently starving under America's sanctions. Or what about Biden's pick for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, an African-American woman who also happens to serve as the vice president on leave to a Swiss mining company called Glencore, which is currently facing corruption charges in the Democratic Republic of Congo. These are just a few of the wonderful imperialists and corporatists that Joe Biden has appointed to his cabinet under the banner of so-called diversity. So joining me to discuss these cabinet picks further is Kevin Gostola, journalist and managing editor at Shadowproof. It's good to have you on, Kevin. How are you?
Yeah, thank you.
Kevin, you've been doing some great coverage on Joe Biden's new cabinet picks. We've been seeing a lot of familiar faces from the Obama days. Is that just a coincidence?
Well, what we're seeing are the people who have the leadership in the Democratic Party, the people who are going to be boosted. That's a an amalgamation of Clinton Democrats, and then you have Obama Democrats. These are kind of the establishment factions that have sort of been at war with each other. Well, they've always had a shared interest to suppress any kind of insurgency from the wing of the party that I usually call the Sanders wing or the Sanders Democrats or maybe the Justice Democrats. And so politically, that's what we see happening. And, you know, to be quite honest, the progressives just really don't have much power to match the influence of the Obama Democrats or the Clinton Democrats. And so what you have is, especially when it comes to foreign policy, you have, you know, the weakest of appeals to liberal imperialism, basically. Like, it's the yeah. disagreements, the arguments are over whether you're going to have a more humanitarian kind of foreign policy that is still interventionist, or you're going to just ditch human rights entirely and show force and wield it with a kind of iron fist globally. And so what you're getting now is the alternative brand of U.S. empire that Biden is about to put forward. We've had 4 years of Donald Trump. We've seen what that could do. It turned off the entire globe, but that doesn't mean that what we're going to get from Joe Biden is going to necessarily be, you know, peace and human rights.
Speaking of foreign policy and empire specifically, can you tell us a bit more about Biden's new defense secretary? We're hearing praise from the media that he is the first black man to lead the Pentagon.
His name is Lloyd Austin, and he's a remarkable figure because it seems like no matter what in the United States, you can't keep people out of our government who have passed in the Iraq War. Lloyd Austin is the fact that he was involved in leading the invasion of Iraq and has boasted about going so quickly from, I believe, Kuwait to the Baghdad city in like a record amount of time. He was able to move forces and go in there and seize Baghdad. And this is his, what he considers to be the most honorable part of his military career, if you read it. And then he pairs it, I think disingenuously, with being involved in the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. However, he and Joe Biden and other Democrats are terrible at how they spin the Iraq withdrawal, because those troops were only, for the most part, removed expeditiously because they were afraid that the Iraqi government was going to start holding U.S. soldiers accountable for war crimes, which was a thing that was a sticking point to a status of forces agreement. So any work that was done to ultimately remove troops from Iraq, first off, I don't see that being like, hey, a tribute to you for removing forces that shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's like, okay, you led this and you know how to remove invaders from a foreign country. Like, great.
Right.
But then there's the issue of the fact that he was at a company called United Technologies that within the last year completed a merger with Raytheon and is now part of one of the biggest weapons manufacturers in the world. There is some truth to the fact that, like, I shouldn't treat him any differently than other Pentagon secretaries. So we've heard that he's a black man, and we should be excited because we're going to have the first black Pentagon secretary in United States history. Okay. But he's also the first black Pentagon military industrial complex leader of the entire world. You know, that's his claim. That's going to be his claim to fame too. And he'll be following in the footsteps of Mark Esper and James Mattis and Patrick Shanahan, who were Trump's defense secretaries. And they all came from defense contractors or weapons companies. In fact, Mark Esper, who he's succeeding, came from Raytheon. So it's as if Raytheon has completely taken control of the Pentagon. Essentially, the revolving door isn't even really a revolving door anymore. It's It's just a complete pipeline from Raytheon to the Pentagon in order for it to funnel money into the coffers of Raytheon for the bombing of children in Yemen or wherever Saudi Arabia might need us to assist them in the Middle East next.
Kevin, thank you so much for your amazing reporting, your insight, and all your analysis. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast by IRIB English Radio.
So, Kevin, what about all these women that Biden has appointed as well? Because the mainstream media is saying we should all be happy that he's putting so many women in key positions of power. However, when you look at the records, Avril Haines, for example, you know, Joe Biden boasts that he has the most diverse cabinet. But what does that mean in this case? What kind of diversity are we really talking about here?
I'd like to give a nod to a journalist who I recently had the opportunity to interview, Roberto Lovato. There's a fantastic book right now on the violence and the interconnectedness of El Salvador and the United States. But he calls this intersectional empire. And that's what we're seeing under Joe Biden, is that we're bringing in all these figures to just have a more multicultural kind of an empire. You know, it's basically going to be an empire that looks like our country. And that's something that people are going to have to confront head on and stop falling for appointing, you know, women or Latinos or gays and lesbians or transgender people. You know, like, without going too far away from, I want to highlight Avril Haines specifically because I think she deserves attention, but without going too far away, there's actually a transgender person who was on his agency review team for his Biden, for the Biden transition. And I couldn't help but laugh because it's a transgender person who's a vet, but it's also somebody who's a contractor for CACI, which was involved in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, was implicated. So the representation that transgender people are getting in Biden's transition is coming from a contractor guilty of torture in Iraq. That's not representation, I think. I think we have to be clear here. I'm not trying to denigrate any group of people, but I'm saying if you really want representation, you need to be putting more demands on political elites, because what you don't want is reinforcing the white heteronormative patriarchy. And I think, like, it's fair to put it that way, because what they're doing is they're weaponizing you against people around the world. And so you have Avril Haines who's coming in. The director of national intelligence position is what she's been picked to be a part of. And she's significant because she is a John Brennan loyalist. She was at the CIA. She was involved in further entrenching the assassination complex for drone warfare and the kill list. She's involved in, you know, they celebrate her as if, like, she was concerned about international law, and she forced them to have a better process and to do more and then just quit killing people every Terror Tuesday with reckless abandon. But what this means is that it just became a more formal part of U.S. government. It was no longer easy to question what Barack Obama was doing. I mean, as he even admits in his latest memoir, he talks about how, like, easy it was to be killing people, essentially. And so, you know, that's what she was involved in. And she came from Palantir, too. She was at Palantir, which is a major security contractor that is implicated in, like, the deportations of immigrants. And the thing that's remarkable, too, is she was at a think tank called CNAS that is funded by oil companies, weapons companies, but it also got money from the Director of National Intelligence, that office which she is now going to be a chair of or running as a director, and then it also received money from Palantir. So it's just amazing, like, when you think about the revolving doors of these people, it's just so incestuous.
So speaking of actually obtaining something substantive, what are progressives getting from this administration and these cabinet picks? People were told that they have to vote for Joe Biden, that he's the lesser of two evils, and once he's elected, you can push him left. Okay, well, I don't see Bernie Sanders' name anywhere on this list. So what are progressives getting exactly from this administration?
The only thing that I think you could say we might gain from a Biden administration is that we won't be bombing Iran. But we also know that we were never going to do that unless the Pentagon changed its calculus, because they've always had their own analysis that says that they would never be able to succeed militarily the way they want to. And so that's always held them back from doing more than just like enlisting Israel to go assassinate nuclear scientists, or engaging in cyber warfare with things like Stuxnet to just completely dismantle the infrastructure. That's Barack Obama. That's where Joe Biden is going next. We're going to see that kind of hybrid warfare. And so I think people really need to be aware that what we have now with a Joe Biden administration is a ramping up of tensions with Russia, a ramping up of tensions with China. The great power competition is going to be extremely fierce. And then with Iran, like, I don't know what they're supposed to do. The government and all the officials didn't do anything wrong when it came to the nuclear deal. Donald Trump decided to completely scrap it. And then now, somehow, in order to get the U.S. back into it, I'm afraid that Joe Biden's going to force Iran to make some kind of concessions, even though they never left the deal. So why should they have to do it? Like, why should they have to be the ones that give anything up? It should be the United States that gives Iran something in order to be back in the nuclear deal, in order to have this agreement. And so I think you asked the right question, which is, what are progressives gaining from this cabinet when it comes to foreign policy? I mean, look at the bill that just passed for the government that had the stimulus package. It contains funding for democracy promotion programs. It contains funding for more of the intervention and regime change operations in Venezuela. It contains funding for the war on drugs in the Caribbean. It contains funding for helping activists continue to destabilize Hong Kong, just so that they can drive a wedge between China and any other countries in the region that it's trying to work with and cooperate with. And so I'm really concerned here. And then the other thing with these people who are in the cabinet that we have to address is that they're completely hawkish on Syria and favor arms being sent to Syria. And also, you've had situations where the Pentagon's funding their own groups that end up going to war with CIA-funded groups. So it's a total satire.
Right. I mean, these picks are total jokes. Pete Buttigieg, a small-town mayor, he's now the transport secretary. The former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, you know, her field of so-called expertise is predominantly foreign policy, yet now she'll be leading the domestic policy council. What are all these weird picks? Is there something transactional or nefarious going on here, as opposed to something based on expertise?
It's transactional. And let me just disclose that I'm actually from the same hometown area that Pete Buttigieg is from. So I have a little insight into the fact that, you know, as far as his transportation experience, he really has none. But what I can tell you is there's a commuter train that runs between that area. There's a commuter train that runs between Chicago and northern Indiana that now he'll be able to use the same way that Mitch McConnell's wife was able to use as transportation secretary. So you know what this means is that he'll be able to jump to the front of line and get federal grants funneled to northern Indiana ahead of every other part of the United States. So it's just going to be an opportunity for Pete Buttigieg to get the gravy train going and put him in a good spot so that he can run for president again and make everybody feel good that he did a nice job as transportation secretary. Meanwhile, he has no knowledge of these systems. And then you raise the issue of Susan Rice. She couldn't get confirmed in a Senate. She never could get confirmed in the Senate because of what she did in Libya. So what are they going to do? Give her a domestic policy council position, which has nothing to do with her field of expertise at all.
I think it's frankly hilarious that anyone would expect anything different from a candidate who told rich donors that nothing would fundamentally change. We can clearly see that Joe Biden is not only returning the favor to those who stood aside for him to clinch the presidency, but just like all presidents before him, he is catering to the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, and the rest of corporate America. Once again, we see the formation of a cabinet run not by the American people, but by the oligarchy and multinational corporations. Joe Biden may be appointing all these women, women of color, people of color, to his cabinet. His cabinet might be diverse in race, orientation, and gender, but it is by no means diverse in terms of policy. What's the point of having a black Secretary of Defense if he's going to keep bombing black and brown people on the other side of the planet? What's the point of appointing a woman Director of National Intelligence if she helps drone strike and displace other women? You know, if Biden cares about women, wouldn't it have been better to not support the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen that has forced critical essential services and clinics to shut down, leaving scores of women without the necessary medical services that they require? As Eric London writes a few weeks ago, quote, "These servants of Wall Street and U.S. imperialism have nothing in common with the working people of their own race, gender, or sexual orientation. It is class, not identity, which is the fundamental dividing line in American society." This intersectional imperialism is just a facade in order to continue the same brutal policies of the U.S. empire, exploiting workers, killing and robbing people of color, all for the enrichment of the corporate elites. This pandering